Do we become more scared of things we don't know? I think we do. I think that's what we see in society. And that pushed me to, okay, somebody needs to freaking take responsibility and bring that conversation back to life about society and culture and who are we, and just being curious. Nudge the curiosity all the time.
That was Lee Gammeltoft, and this is Nordic Portraits. Lee Gammeltoft is a DJ, radio host, and entrepreneur who has spent the past two decades exposing Danish audiences to bold new sounds through her dynamic live sets and high-profile radio programs. In recent years, Lee has emerged as one of the leading figures in the national media landscape, having established the digital media company Heartbeats. Lee, welcome to Nordic Portraits.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Lee, I wondered if we could start by going back to the early stages of your career, because you started out as a presenter on Voice TV, and it feels like that was not the obvious pathway to becoming a high-profile DJ.
Yeah. Oh my God, my career has been weird. I've never had like that one direction. It's been very unfocused, you might say. But I've always loved music, and I think just getting the chance of presenting music and all the new sounds on Voice TV, which was a new TV station. And I was doing the presenting of the videos, but most of all, I did all the interviews with the musicians. And after doing that for a year, all the labels found out that I actually knew something about music, and I didn't have cue cards, and I just knew how to talk to the musicians. And they were always like, where are your cue cards? And who are telling you this? I'm like, I just know music and it interests me. So when I stopped at Voice TV, I got a job at Universal Music and doing the PR for the American artists. And then it just being around people making music and working with music all the time, I had this idea all of a sudden that maybe I can't sing, I can't play guitar, I can't do anything. I would love to be a rock star, but I can't be it. And then I started DJing just, you know, to be able to get that intuition that I have about music, get it out there and work with it in a different way than I did as a press person, yeah.
Can you remember what that feeling was like when you bought your first mixing console and brought it back to your lounge room and started experimenting?
Yeah, but I'm such a slob. I mean, I bought it because I thought it would be cool, but I didn't really do anything about it. So I had the decks in my flat, and all of a sudden, instead of me going out and DJing and getting my first gig or rehearsing a lot, all the DJs from the Copenhagen scene came to me after they'd been out playing their gigs. They came to me for after parties. So I had like Tandemuller and Rune Ako, Kulsh, guys like those, standing in my flat at 4 o'clock in the morning, DJing on my small system there. And I don't know, it took me a year, I think. And I had a friend working at Universal Music, and he had a small bar and club in Copenhagen. And he said, yeah, I've heard about your DJ dreams for like 6 months now. So come on, you can play at my club on Thursday. Like, fuck. Okay. Yeah. And I didn't know how to mix. And I just did it, really. One of my first gigs was with a Danish musician called Mikael Simpson. He's very, very lovely guy, a little bit arrogant. And I remember putting on a Prince vinyl, and he just removed it and said, yeah, I don't want to play with anybody playing Prince. I was like, oh, I freaking love Prince. But I think it was just the networking part of it made it easy for me getting going and getting the jobs. And then I did what everybody else does. I just went out at the cafes and the burger joints and whatever and played for people who didn't really give, you know. But it was fun, and all of a sudden I had the chance of playing like 3, 4, 5, 6 hour gigs for people who didn't really listen. And then I learned how to mix and learned all the technical stuff, and yeah, I was flying.
The craft of a DJ is something that I'm not afraid to say I know very little about. It feels like a bit of a black box to me, but can you describe the euphoria or sense that you have when you're in the zone and really connecting with an audience?
I think there are different types of DJs, and I think that's what we have to clear up a little bit, because I think a lot of the bigger DJs in the EDM and all of that is very much a set. They're playing the same. I never, ever do that. And I'm not like a genre specific DJ. I was in the beginning because it's very easy just playing deep house or just playing tech, whatever. I see myself as more eclectic, like Balearic DJ. I can play whatever in a set and think it's fun. But it makes it more difficult as well because you need to think and feel the floor. But what happens if you have the right intuition and you're taking it as a new experience every time you're behind the decks? First of all, you need to be out there in the crowd. Your feelings, you need to be able to feel them. So it's very out of body sensation. But to see them reacting to the music and you're laying the music as small tiles for a path that they need to go, and all of a sudden it just explodes and you have them on the tables, on the couches, wherever. It's the adrenaline kick is amazing. And seeing them react, for me, music is feelings and it's a story as well that I want to tell. And seeing that they get it, you know, and we are in it together, it's really big. So yeah, I couldn't sleep when I came home from my gigs because it was just pounding through me. It's like, shit, thousands of people just partying and going crazy with me because it was with me. I didn't do it for them, I did it with them. It was amazing and I still miss it a little bit. I haven't been DJing for years now.
So where did this path you were on first intersect with that of Kjell Tostrup?
Kjell, I met, he was like a legendary DJ and he inspired a lot of people because he was very open about music. He could listen to the most commercial stuff and he didn't look down on it. He always saw the qualities in the music and, you know, tried to embrace it as just, okay, maybe this is very commercial, but I can see the production's really good or whatever. And I met him while I was at Universal Music. We had Nine Black Elves and Kaiser Chiefs, two English bands in Denmark for Monday night. And we were trying to find out where to go out. And Kjell and I, we met and clicked and found out that Monday night in Copenhagen back then was really difficult, no places to go. So we ended up at like the strip joint with these young English blokes who was taken a little bit by surprise, I think. It was pretty filthy and dirty. But Kjell and I was just sitting at the bar and talking. And it was just best friendship happening right there. And then he took me in as a co-host at his radio show. I started doing radio shows. And Kjell, he had a show called Unga Bunga. And it was every Friday night for 3 hours, presenting all the newest, coolest underground electronic tunes. And he was, I think every host knows this, that it's easier to have somebody to talk to in the studio. It's easier being a co-host than being single in the studio. So I think he needed somebody to talk with and present with, and he persuaded National Radio to bring me in. So then it just took off. We made like the biggest brand. That radio show was the most amazing thing I've ever done. I still think a lot about it. People still write me that they miss it. You know, it's been years since we ended it.
Do you miss it?
I miss it, yeah. I don't miss doing it alone because Kjell died years ago, and I continued presenting at Unga Bunga and doing that show for a couple of years, and it was different. It was just, again, I didn't have that kickback from Kjell. We had a lot of humor in it, and it was fun. He could challenge me in a way that sitting there alone was just, it became too easy, sorry. And when things are easy, I become a little sloppy. So I miss the days with him, really, yeah. I think I miss it almost every day.
Do you remember exactly where you were when you found out that Kjell had passed?
Yeah, I was at National Radio getting ready at Tuesday morning for going live. I had a show from noon to 2 o'clock called Smag på P3 with like 500,000 listeners, I think. And I was sitting at my desk getting ready and my phone rang and it was our mutual friend Peter Visti, very big DJ. And he just said, "You know why I'm calling you." And yeah, I was like, "What? Yeah, you know why I'm calling." And yeah, he passed away Sunday. Then we had a couple of days where we got together with family and friends and trying to sort the funeral. And yeah, then I went on air Friday and doing Unga Bunga memorial show for Kjell. All the big DJs and producers came to the studio and we had like 4 hours live, everybody playing a track that reminded them of him. I just got hold of that show. I haven't heard it ever since. When is this?
2011.
Yeah, exactly. I think April, May 2011. I haven't heard it since. But old fan of Unga Bunga sent me, we transfer link the other day, so now I have the show. And I heard the intro. I was like, yeah, I'll take it bit by bit. I listened to like the first track. I was like, yeah, that's enough. I'll listen to it some other day with a gin tonic and, you know.
Because that relationship strikes me as much more than just friendship or obviously bonding over music. I mean, you were sparring partners, almost mentor, father figure relationship. Is that a stretch to say that?
No. Best friend, mentor, a little bit of a dad as well. Gave me some really good advice. He was very calm in a way that I'm not. And he always said to me, nobody stresses Lee out as Lee. It's like, yeah, that's true, actually. You know, now I'm older and I'm a little wiser and my, you know, I can breathe a little more now, but he was very good at trying to, you know, make me use my energy in the right way instead of making everything like in a blur. Sometimes when you're very ADHD, it's like, yeah, it's too much. So he contained the energy a little bit, but it was an amazing relationship. And I have him, I don't have him, but I have a tattoo of a small ghost. That is Kill, because he visits me sometimes. So he's with me every day.
How does that look when he visits you?
Yeah, it can be weird music starting to play without me putting it on. It can be a chair that moves. It can be just my thoughts. It can be me thinking what would this company have been like if he had been here with me. It can be, you know, all sorts of emotions. And also just the memory of seeing him behind the decks at a party, me coming into the party really drunk or trying to persuade him to let me play a couple of tracks in the middle of the night. It can be, yeah, it can be everything. But a lot about the work as well, because we had a record label. We started releasing compilations, Sound of Copenhagen, because we were standing in the clubs in Copenhagen and all these amazing producers were doing great remixes and great productions. And there were just no labels taking it on. You couldn't get it out there. And people will give the burned CDs or a USB or whatever and hand it over. And it was just in the underground between us. So how could we get that music out there? We could, of course, play it at the radio show Unga Bunga, but what about making it available for people to buy and have it at home? So we started Sound of Copenhagen compilations, and we did like every year, every 6 months, every year. I can't really remember. And then it actually progressed into being a label. And we've been releasing some of the biggest artists at home. We found them and worked with them in the beginning. And now they're really, really big. So we had that intuition. Kit was really good at it. But doing underground label for electronic music in Denmark is bad business, I must say.
But what sort of sense of gratification do you get when you see a band that would have been otherwise passed over by the public suddenly rise to prominence?
I'm really, really proud of it. I think we did a difference for the musicians in Denmark, but I always think that maybe somebody else would have found them maybe just a couple of years later. I think it's why, even though I've been doing like radio shows and been branding myself as somebody who is in some point a little famous in Denmark, it's always respect that people meet me with because I've been doing something that didn't have anything to do with me. It's always been the music and the musicians and trying to do the work for them. And it was very purpose driven. And I think when I meet musicians now that, you know, I can call somebody up and they're like, oh my God, you released my first single ever. Why are you ringing me? It's amazing. Like, did I? So it's very respectful, I think. And I enjoy that, that people don't take me for somebody who just want to do something for me, an influencer sort of type, but really want to bring out the music for people to listen to it, because if it moved me, it must move somebody else as well.
You mentioned that Kel often noted that no one stresses Lee like Lee.
Yeah.
And maybe an ADHD tendency. How would you have described Lee as a young girl? You grew up in Lyngby, close to Copenhagen. Both parents were doctors, is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
What were you like as a student at school, for example?
Oh, well, shit. I couldn't wrap my brain around it. I didn't get why I had to learn all that stuff. And that's what I'm working with now, trying to influence the politicians a little bit about how we teach kids. Maybe it would be a good idea to say, do you know why you need to learn math? I'm trying to teach my 10-year-old. Do you know, in my company, Money comes in when we do a project, but I have to give money out as well for the employees that you've met in the office. And that is actually math. That is what we do. Ah, okay. And, you know, it's at a very small level, but I didn't get that feeling of that it made any point. And what happens with me, and I still have that issue, when I'm not interested, I can't concentrate. So if there's no point in it, if it doesn't push me a little bit, if it doesn't grab me, either challenges me or makes sense to me, then I can't concentrate. And then I'm really annoying to be around, really. And I think my concentration, it tends to go from like 10 minutes to an hour, and I can sit in a meeting now. And if it takes too long, 45 minutes, I'm like, yep, okay, I'm done. So school was weird.
Yet you did go on to further study after high school, completing your English Lit major at university.
Yeah.
What made you pursue that?
I figured out, I think in high school, that the literature and writing and analyzing words was something that I'm good at that. I have that analytic sense. And then I lived in England for a year. I lived in Cotswolds, out in the countryside. And I brought my horse there. I was a competitive rider. And I really wanted to study Danish because I like Danish literature and I wanted to do that. And because I've been so crappy at high school, I didn't get into Danish or Nordic Lit, I think it's called now. But my second option was English because I was like, yeah, probably pretty much the same. But I remember getting in and I was just annoyed that I had to do this because it wasn't what I wanted. But I enjoyed it a lot and I tried to just be a part of everything. So I really dived into it. But I knew as a English Lit student, it's not going to be jobs that are going to fall all over me. So I need to get a resume that's great. So I started working after, 2.5, 3 years.
If we go back to 2014, you took a career step that from an outsider's perspective may have seemed quite bold and unexpected. That being your move to establishing your own radio station, as well as what has since morphed into a larger digital media company. Can you tell me what internally drove you to that decision and how you felt walking into that new frontier?
I think, first of all, I've been working as a journalist at different magazines a couple of years before I started the music business. So I know how to write and I like media. But I think it was the sense of national radio not taking responsibility for the new musicians and for the Danes, for the listeners as well, that pushing that curiosity. We need to be pushed by media to listen to something new and read something new and get a new perspective. It is the responsibility of media to put things into perspective and push us as human beings all the time. And what happened in Denmark, all the newspapers just got rid of the journalists covering music and movies and stuff like that because there was no clicks in it. There was no readers. There was no money. So they let them go from a time where we had somebody who only did rock reviews and hip hop and then somebody for theater and somebody for classical. And they were all put together to one person. Now you need to know a little bit about everything. And that got to me. It frustrated me a lot. And then going to national radio, where they did that very, very hardcore playlisting, playing the same music all the time and not giving the hosts the responsibility for their programs and shows as well to put music on that could actually push a little bit and take the listeners by hand and saying, do you know what? I know you respect me and you feel safe with me as a host. I have found this new track. You might hate it, but give it a try. We'll take 3.5 minutes out of your life and listen to this together. And if you hate it, fine. But just, you know, give me the time. And we couldn't do that. Nobody was allowed to do that anymore. And at the same time, you could see the society, Denmark was just closing down, really. We didn't like foreigners much. And we became sort of in the politics, and politicians became almost racist. And taking the curiosity away from us and the understanding of culture away from us makes us more and more, do we become more scared of things we don't know? I think we do. I think that's what we see in society. And that pushed me to, okay, somebody needs to freaking take responsibility and bring that conversation back to life about society and culture and who are we and just being curious, nudge the curiosity all the time. And that's why I started Heartbeats.
You did fire a few parting shots at Denmark's radio on the way out.
Oh, yeah.
How was that received?
I was the first one who actually had the guts, I think, to go out and really criticize Denmark's Radio. If I know I'm not getting a job there again, and then never gonna, I do get invited to shows once in a while as a guest. But I think it's the top of national radio I criticize. It's the strategic decisions I criticize. A lot of the hosts and a lot of people working there are like, either you're for or you're against. And I don't see that. I never criticize the hosts because I think they're really, really great people working there. But I think the strategy for the national radio and for Denmark's Radio in general is just, it's very populistic, almost like it's a commercial station now. But people have been taking it a bit too close to heart, I think, even though it didn't have anything to do with them, really. But it's fine now, and everybody's been criticizing it ever since, so.
Yeah. So you dive headfirst into this new project. At the same time, you're also the owner of a bar in Copenhagen.
Mm-hmm.
You're continuing to run a record label.
Yeah.
Perhaps, unsurprisingly, in hindsight, late 2014, you go down with stress.
Yeah.
Can you describe how that felt in the moment when you first sensed that things were starting to come apart at the seams for you?
I think I didn't really want to realize it. It became so severe that I was dizzy 24 hours a day. I couldn't, you know, concentrate. I couldn't look people in the eye. I couldn't have a conversation. I couldn't be with people. And I became very introvert all of a sudden. And it was actually sitting at the bar. I think it was my birthday. So the bar was full of people that I know and really good friends. But I was sitting outside in a yard on my own. And this regular from the bar came up to me and he was like, "What the fuck are you doing out here? You should be with your friends inside, but you look like shit. You should take care of yourself and you are not feeling well." It's like, maybe. Maybe there's a point to that. But I went to a lot of doctors and, you know, maybe I have that virus on the, I don't, you can have a virus in your ear that makes you dizzy. I thought maybe it could be that. Maybe my eyes, maybe I should get like glasses or something. Maybe that's why I'm dizzy. So I tried to just get around it a lot. And I never just took the time off. I never took like 3-6 months out. But I tried to not DJ so long hours. So my booker, he was told I can play 2 hours and no later than 1 a.m. then I need to go home. So I just tried to cut back a little bit on the hours.
So being such a strong, capable person and suddenly being struck down by the physical symptoms of stress, did that teach you any hard lessons about being vulnerable or needing to ask others for help?
Absolutely. I think maybe not asking for help. I'm not quite there yet. But I think the fact that I have like a body therapist and he's very much into, you know, if I become dizzy, it's not, I don't really do that anymore. You have to ask yourself, why are there no room for you in that situation? Why can't you breathe? Because you forget to breathe. So it's been a very interesting development for me to actually try to feel myself and be in me and why I'm reacting like I am and what's going on. And I'm not quite there yet. I don't think I'll ever get, you know, right down in my feet. But it's good. And I think I'm getting better as a person because I can take the tempo out of it a little bit and reflect a little bit more and maybe figure out that it doesn't have to happen right now. It can happen tomorrow or in a month. It's fine. But I need to practice that every freaking day. Tomorrow is another day.
And how about on the personal front? You described your early years as being an absolute social animal.
Yeah.
What does life look like for you now away from work after going down with stress?
Yeah, I have that schizophrenic life that I have kids 7 days, you know, every other week. And those days I'm pretty much just working kids and maybe going out when they sleep. And then the other week is insane. But I'm very good at saying no. I mean, I get invited to a lot of different things and I'm really happy that I do get the invitations. I'm not getting as many anymore because I'm saying no. But I think it fills me up being out and socializing with good friends. And now I have the energy to do my networking bit again. I have been a little off my game in that sense. But it gives me a lot of energy meeting people who are better than me and can teach me something or have like a different mental state where I can look a little bit up to them. Okay, wow, I can, you know, I can move in that direction or work-wise, I can learn something here. And I like that. And then I, you know, have a week full of going out, eating really good food in the Copenhagen food scene. Wow. Yeah. And drinking a lot of drinks and going around listening to music. And then I'll crash the week with the kids and just chill with them and cooking them dinner that they don't eat.
You mentioned how much you like being exposed to people who provide you with new perspectives. Mm. How are you then at receiving criticism? You seem like someone who very much enjoys challenging yourself without any sort of fragile ego sitting at the center of everything.
No, not at all. I think criticism is fine, but it depends on who delivers it. And if I respect the people that gives me the criticism, I will take it to heart. I will listen. But sometimes people criticize because they themselves are a little, their self-esteem aren't that great. And then I'm like, should I listen or not? But yeah, I think I don't really give anymore what people think of me. People that I respect a lot, I enjoy their respect back. But in the general sense of people liking me, I think I've been the last 15, maybe 20 years, pretty easy going about. Of course, some people don't like me. And of course, some people think I'm doing the wrong. And some people think that I'm a sloppy, arrogant, I don't know, whatever. Yeah. All right.
Since establishing Heartbeats, you've very much remained hands-on as a host. One program that you've been at the helm of for many years is The Bucket List,
yeah,
whereby you host conversations with well-known Danes and cultural figures about death.
Mm.
What interests you particularly about death as a taboo?
I think all taboos interest me, really. I think we need to be more honest, and I think we need to be better in those kinds of conversations. Danes are pretty closed and putting off the big, heavy conversations. And I think it's a shame because I feel sorry for the people when it sort of comes like a surprise to them. So, yeah, we're all going to die. So why not talk about it and try to figure out how we feel about it? And what happens if my mum is not here anymore or my friend or if I'm, you know, and also trying to get that conversation started about, if you have a dream, then you have to live it. I'm very much the kind of person that just jumps into things without thinking it through and not afraid of not having a job and not afraid of taking chances. And I think the more honest we are and the more vulnerable we are, the stronger we are as well. So I think that conversation actually makes us stronger. And I think it's so interesting listening to people talking about their experiences with death and holding somebody's hand and the soul. You know, we are all very different in the perspective of what happens when we die. And we are very different in the way we live and how we make choices. So it's a place where the conversation can go really deep. And I like that. I like that opportunity of just getting right down there.
What surprised you the most by doing that program in terms of what you were hearing from the person sitting opposite you?
I think I'm surprised by, honestly, I'm an atheist, so I still get surprised when people think, you know, that there is a God. The religion bit of it, it's very interesting to me because I don't have that. So learning their perspective in that, what it gives them believing in God. But I think what really surprises me is how many people have had some kind of experience with somebody who died. You know, coming back to them or having sort of a sense of an energy or soul. And I don't know if it's because, like me with Kit, that I just want him to be there. Maybe it's my mind. Maybe there's nothing out there. I don't know, but so many people have had that very emotional, strong connection to somebody coming back to them after they died. That's pretty insane.
Hmm. Are you someone who likes to actively explore your own sense of spirituality?
I don't explore it. I think I'm more like, there's just stuff I can't explain. What is that? But I mean, I don't even really understand why a plane is in the air. When I sit in a plane, I'm like, wow, I get raffled by the universe and how big it is. And is it, it's so big and why the fuck are we here? It can really get me off my game. But I've controlled my thoughts quite a bit. So when it's like too big, I can pull it back. But I think it's interesting. All the conversations about death and what happens, is there an afterlife? Is there energy? What is a soul? What happens, you know? But I don't know if I believe in any of it. I'm still trying to figure it out. I think I'll try to figure it out until I die and then I'll have the answer, you know?
Another taboo that you've been very proactive in talking about recently is that of miscarriage.
Yeah.
You recently released your first book entitled Table or The Loss that you co-wrote with Marie Nergård.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious why you chose that moment in particular to share your story and go public with your own experiences of miscarriage.
I think it's, I've had a couple of miscarriages. My number, if you can say, I've been pregnant 5 times. I have 2 kids. I've actually been pregnant with 6 kids, 1 time with twins. When I had my second child, I knew that I've had my kids, that those are my kids. I'm not getting any more. And it wasn't as vulnerable to me anymore because the dream had sort of come to life. And the project, I succeeded, you know, I can't say it's a project, but it was a little bit. And I enjoy being the not the spokesperson, but being brave enough. Yeah, I'm brave enough going out and starting that conversation, like I'm starting other conversations as well. And it was time for me, and I felt strong enough to talk about it. And I just released an article at Heartbeats about the miscarriages and how I felt and, you know, my number, hashtag 52. And that just became insanely big overnight. People like 10-1, 10-2-1, because they lost live kids as well. And feeling that impact of, wow, I had felt so alone about the miscarriages and had nobody around me to talk to because nobody understood what it was like. And all of a sudden, we created this community of people that came together and was like, I felt alone and I'm still feeling alone. And thank you for making this community come to life and we can talk to each other and recognize our feelings in each other's feelings. And it's been really, really strong. And people are still writing me like on a weekly basis that I'm at hospital right now having a miscarriage. It's my 5th or 10th or whatever. And I just, you know, big heart, big hug. You're not alone. We're all here. But just getting word back that it actually makes a difference. It's really freaking amazing.
Yeah. One other aspect of the book that I found particularly interesting was that you spoke to a lot of scientists and researchers as well.
Mm.
What did you learn through that process from a scientific perspective about an issue that we very rarely talk about?
I've learned a couple of things, but I think one thing that I learned was that there's no money in research for miscarriages in Denmark. Nobody really looks at it like something we should research in because it's not a disease. So that is a frustrating part of it. Another thing I learned is that a lot of women can get boys because our body attacks the fetus when the chromosomes are developed in week 8, I think. And that became maybe an explanation to me why I had the miscarriages. Maybe it's because I can't get boys. And a lot of doctors said that to me. I was like, wow, okay, that's an explanation I can actually use because then it's statistics. Then I will, you know, get pregnant with a girl again sometime. I have 2 girls. I also found out that the grief is one-to-one the same pretty much between all of us. What we go through, all the emotions, it's pretty much the same. I can relate to every single person I've talked to. That's amazing. I don't feel alone about it anymore. It's a part of me and a part of my story now, but I'm also a part of a really, really strong community where we all know what we're talking about. We can just look each other in the eye and I know.
Mm.
And I think that's strong. So yeah, I learned on different levels a lot. Also, I think just doing all the interviews and just sitting there, and it wasn't about me and my story, but I could just sit there and work through my emotions, listening to these women's and men's stories. And it was so emotional, just processing my grief, I think for the first time, really getting, you know, shit, I can just recognize all of it. I'm sitting there in the studio, turning off the mic and just crying. It's like, yeah. So I think it's been a process, not just for the readers, but yeah, for me as well.
And it's one thing to hear those stories as part of the process of writing the book and sharing your own journey, but I could imagine it's also quite something else to then be a default spokesperson for this cause, whether you wanted that or not. You're a public figure, but you are contactable. You've made yourself available.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to hear all of these stories? Do you find that draining, or is it something that you just accept as part and parcel of sharing your own journey?
I don't know why, but I find it very easy being with other people's emotions. I'm the kind of friend also, I have several friends that are diagnosed with cancer, and I'm the one they can talk to about death. They can talk to me about those really heavy things that they go through. So I think I feel very fortunate that people want to share it with me, and that I, you know, just sending them a recognition. I recognize you, I hear you, just a hug. I can't do anything for them anyway, but it makes it, what happens if you write something down and send it to somebody else, it becomes the truth. Now it's out there. It's not just for me anymore. Now I share it with somebody. And the process of that is so important for these people. So it's got nothing to do with my answer. It's just them knowing that I got it, I read it, I recognized it, and I'm here. So no, it doesn't drain me at all. That's the least I can do. I started this, now I have to, you know.
Well, one person you yourself have looked to for inspiration and support over the years has been your own mother.
Yeah.
The way you describe her, she sounds like a remarkable person.
She is. She is insane. Yeah, I love her.
What do you find so inspirational about her?
I think she has that combination of strength and vulnerability that she put in me as well. I recognize it in her, and I think she's found a really good balance. I think she's brave as well. She's taking choices that maybe isn't right off the bat for other people. She's 78, still working. She looks freaking amazing. She is fun, crazy, and she's doing stuff that really interests her. I mean, she's traveling the world when she's off from work, just listening to opera. She's a Wagner fan, and she's just, you know, listening to hours and hours, 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 hours of opera. So she's very purpose-driven as a doctor, and she's an entrepreneur. She's had her own clinic, and she loves culture, and she is brave enough to just go after the life that she wants and not listening too much to other people. But I think I've grown past her, and she's very cool about that. She's like, your personal development has just gone so much faster than mine, she says, because I've been encouraged in it, and it's a different time, of course. But she's been very inspiring in that matter of just, you can't just live somebody else's life. You need to be able to find some sort of personal truth.
I'm curious, Lee, now that you have reached this stage of your career where you're well and truly established as one of the key players in the Danish media landscape, and you're someone who can actually shape the cultural and political conversation, What's currently on your agenda in terms of issues you'd like to influence or even just cast a spotlight on?
I think there's a couple of things. I've been working for 6 or 7 years for the Mediestøtte in Denmark, which is like a public support for media. And that was brought to life for print papers, for the old newspapers. And the finances going to the media now has been still just given to media that are primarily text-based, which is insane, because I think we use media and news in a different way now, that a podcast can't be news and video can't be news. So I've been working on the Mediestøtte to be changed, so it's all formats. And I think that's coming along this year. So check. The thing I find very frustrating about politics is that politicians don't really know anything about what they're doing. I have a lot of respect for them going into the field, and you know, they're very driven, purpose-driven as well. They want to make a difference. But if you have like a minister of media and culture and whatever, they don't know anything about media. Do the people at the ministry know anything about? I don't really think they do. They don't really know anything about the modern media landscape. That is so frustrating. So I think now I'm just taking my eyes off that and trying to figure out what can I do with maybe inspiring more young females going into entrepreneurship and doing their own businesses. I'm working with a lot of politicians about that. How can we influence girls to start their own businesses? And that's got something to do with the school system. It's got something to do with role models and maternity leave. And it's so complex. But I think that is really, really fun. So trying to just work on it feels where everybody else is not just crawling on top of each other and trying to make it easier for the people coming after me. It's easier now making a modern media in Denmark, maybe a little bit because of me. And if I can make it easier for female entrepreneurs getting investment or whatever, that would be fine. So all the time thinking, can I make it easier for the next one? I think that's my purpose right now.
Would you be open to entering the political arena?
I don't think so. I think I'm too much of a hothead. I think I would say, you know, I always, at big meetings, I'm invited into Christiansborg, into the politicians quite often, and I always say something that is very fucked up, you know, yeah, because I always speak my mind, and I think I need to do that because I'm best there. And I think the public would maybe not find that it's so charming.
You might be surprised.
I don't know. I tend to never say no. It's so boring saying no. My employees don't say no either. If people come with an assignment or a project or a job offer or whatever, it can scare the shit out of you. And then it's probably the right thing. If it's way too big for you, and how can I do it? Yeah. Okay, then we'll do it. So never say no. I'm pretty much open to anything, I think.
Just as we draw to a close, Lee, what fills you up creatively when you're in need of inspiration?
I think it's not having too much to do, really. Just having a day at the office where I'm not doing anything, just clicking refresh, you know? I got an idea this morning for something I wanted to write because I've been like, I just had time in an airplane the other day and had 1.5 hours just sitting with my eyes closed, and the calm and the nobody speaking to me, or going wind bathing, or, you know, in a sauna, whatever, and trying to get that. It's when I don't really have a specific assignment and project that I'm working on, just time. But I also get very creative for conceptual thinking when we're like, now, we have 10 minutes, figure it out. Then I can really. So it depends on if it's a concept I need to work on for a client, or is it something where I have like a bigger cause or an opinion I need to figure out, then I need the time. So it depends. Creativity thrives in different scenes, I think.
And is that something you value in family life? Your girls are still quite young.
Yeah, 6 and 10.
So I'm just always interested, without going down the well-worn path of avoiding screen time, etc., how you encourage your daughters to also express their creativity and be present.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we made like a creative space for them in the basement with a big desk and a lot of shit where they can glue and paint and whatever. And I don't have to clean it up, and I don't have to take any notice if they spill or cut or glue furniture together. Because in the basement, I just made a table for it and they sit there for hours. The youngest one, she's like, Mum, I'm going to the basement and I'm just going to bring a knife because if there's a monster, I can slash it, but I'll just sit in the table. She can sit there for hours alone in the basement. I don't know what she's doing. She's making a mess, but it's okay because it's not at the dining table. It's not in my couch. So I think trying to do that is really important for me, and trying to get them to just jump into the creative process. But I must say they learn that from YouTube as well, and TikTok. They reference a lot from YouTube. Mum, this trial, I've seen that if you mix this with that, and then you can, like, what? Yeah, it's on YouTube. They say that a lot. And then they go to the basement and try it out, you know. So maybe there's the inspiration that maybe I didn't get. They are lucky enough to get it from their phones and from their iPads, and then they can go out in real life and try to practice it. So if we use the screens in the right way, I think it's not all that bad. But yeah, when I'm tired, they do sit a lot and watch shit. I don't know. Yeah. But I do that as well. I'm like, I can just sit and watch shit and just laugh. Oh my God. It's like an alpaca that's dancing weird, or a dog and a cat. And I love animal videos. And I think it's just the perfect break for my brain. And it's a good laugh as well. So if I react to that, of course they do as well. They actually just learn something from it. I don't.
I think given how productive you are, Lee, you can afford yourself a break or two.
With an alpaca.
Lee, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking the time and for sharing your story with me today.
Thanks. It's been really nice talking to you.
Nordic Portraits is a series by me, Ben Catford. The music was composed by Nina Liu, and the visual identity by Copenhagen-based studio Frame. To learn more about today's guest and all the others from this season, visit nordicportraits.net. You can also follow us on Instagram, and remember to rate and subscribe on iTunes so we can get the word out. Thanks for listening.